There really is no more to be said to the puppets reciting the script of the state. The state. That bloated, disease-bearing tick buried headfirst in the flesh of people like you and me. People who by now have long since had quite enough. No more to be said other than, go away. Others might use stronger, more colourful, forceful language, and I have done in the past, of course, and I likely will again, but no more will I reflexively expend the energy necessary to deliver the sort of expletives and profanities many might insist are called for now. Well, okay, I might force myself. But in essence, all I really have now is go away. That's the limit of it. I have no more heightened blood pressure to offer, no more high dudgeon, no more righteous indignation of the sort that used to have me leap to my feet, or at least push to the edge of my seat. No more of the sort of outrage that may seem to many out there appropriate. I say this because the state, the British state, together with its lick-spittle, limp-biscuit functionaries, is less than a joke. Utterly, utterly beneath the contempt of real people. For me, the last straw, or rather the final moistened sigh of flatulence settling wetly onto the muck-bespattered field of public discourse, was Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer, PM, Prime Minister, a job description now utterly debased. Keir Starmer's announcement of a social media ban for under-16s, and therefore digital IDs as the necessary pass for everyone else wanting to do so much as use YouTube to learn how they might change the filter on a tumble dryer.
I'm joined now by the founder and CEO of Tally Money, Cameron Parry. So what is Tally Money and what does it do?
So you get an everyday account in your individual name, you get an account number and sort code. But instead of having an account denominated in pounds sterling with your bank, you have milligrams of gold, which we brand as Tally. The reason why we chose gold, everybody understands gold. It's universally understood and accepted. It's been increasing at over 11% on average for the last 25 years against the pound. In the last 2 years, it's up 60% against the pound. So if you had, you know, £10,000 in a Tally account 2 years ago, it's now got £16,000 worth of value. The gold hasn't changed, but the value and your purchasing power has. And so banks can't keep up with that performance.
How easy is it to get a Tally Money account then?
If you're a UK resident, it's really easy. Just go to your app store, download the app. You'll need photo ID. You can onboard yourself in a couple of minutes.
Just your passport, your driving license.
Yep. And you're up and away. So you know what you're getting. It's very simple, low fees. It's transparent. There's no hidden fees. There's no FX spreads depending on the amount you put in. And you just get to go ahead and be productive in your daily life, build up your savings again, because yeah, it's useful to do it now.
I was going to say, so you don't necessarily, if people are watching this going, oh, it sounds a bit scary. You can open a Tally Money account, transfer. Is there a minimum amount you have to transfer?
No.
So you might think, I'm just going to play with this. I'm going to put 100 quid in it that I've got this month, and I'm either going to spend it and see if I feel like I'm getting more value for money from my sale, from the things that I'm buying, or I'm going to save it and watch how that compares to maybe 100 quid in your current account.
To find out more and to get an exclusive GB News offer, simply scan the QR code or click the link in the description.
Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, I might have been goaded to frothing anger at such a travesty, at such a blatant display of determination to pose as a dictator. But I watched his little clip, sat there, wearing someone else's zip-up hoodie, imagining, perhaps, that the kids he's using as human shields for the latest bid to control what anyone and everyone says, that those put upon under-16s will see him thus attired and finally see the world the way he's told to say he sees the world by whomever buys him his clothes, helps him into them and writes his scripts and stands behind the camera to give him the wide-eyed encouragement to keep going, keep reading and mugging, while perhaps his mind drifts towards wondering what sort of evidence might be being heard in the court listening to the trial of those Ukrainian lads charged with setting fire to some of his stuff. But as I say, that world of my enraged reaction to whatever display of audacity has most recently been coughed up, the latest glistening pavement oyster hoiked up by the emphysemic myrmidons of the evidently moribund state, that world is gone now. And so I watch Starmer and his impotent ilk mugging and gurning and doing their best to do human, to appear like the rest of us. The rest of us who, after years, decades of incessant interference by the slippery-fingered factotums of authority, have long since had enough. I watch videos like this, latest fronted by Starmer, and all I feel in my innards is revulsion, and all I can summon to say is, go away. My first thought, even before the request that he and his sort simply go away, my first thought is the certainty that this latest move has nothing to do with protecting children. Nothing whatever. Less than nothing. That this is the sine qua non of less than nothing to do with protecting children. It's so cynical. It's so blatantly, transparently, unavoidably cynical. This social media ban, which is in reality only the umpteenth bid to force digital ID over the line, has nothing to do with protecting children in the same way, just as a for instance, that those COVID jabs had nothing to do with safety and or effectiveness. While we're back on that subject, let's remember always and forever that while those jabs were pushed relentlessly towards children, they had at no point been tested on children to see if they were safe for children, in the same way that they hadn't been tested on pregnant women to see if they were safe or not safe for the pregnant women into whom they were jabbed. Just as none of it was about saving granny, as we were relentlessly told by the propaganda. In fact, granny and grandpa were dying alone and scared in hospitals and nursing homes, often helped on their way by morphine and midazolam cocktails. Just as nothing about the so-called pandemic was about what they said it was about, so the tampering with social media has nothing, nothing I say, to do with protecting children. Children are abused in Britain in the most appalling and sickening ways by their many thousands, in a horror that has been going on in town after town, city after city for decades, and still next to nothing is done that means anything real, if stopping it was the objective. Children, along with their families, are murdered day after day in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Iran, and month after month, and year after year. All I can say about that is that the state does less than nothing to stop it. All around the world, children are made to suffer in the worst and most unforgivable ways, to suffer on account of the evident disdain of those supposedly tasked with their well-being. And yet, against the backdrop of that, the reality of all that, we're expected to believe another politician preaching about the need to protect children. Again, I say, go away. This is about forcing digital ID onto a population, whether that population wants it or not. No more and no less. My second thought is that it will not work anyway. Not a chance. Life, as we were told in the Jurassic Park movies, will find a way. I think about prohibition in the United States of America in the 1920s and 30s, when the state ban on alcohol saw millions of folks find their ways around the ban. In the arms race for control of tech, and the state faces an existential crisis if it cannot stop people using tech to tell each other what's really going on out there. In the arms race for control of that tech, the state will lose. The state, states all over the world, are always outsmarted about tech. A reasonable person has only to count the ways and times data, usually personal data about citizens, is hacked and traded in the real world. The state fantasy of state-centralised, state-controlled information for the purposes of propagandising the people will only and inevitably and absolutely, certainly, I say, result in the mummy and daddy of all failures. Whatever cage is built will be avoided, circumvented, and made a nonsense of by whom? by the people. Because the people, being alive, being life in that way that machines are not, will find a way, will find many, many ways. My kids and my kids' friends talk about how they've already seen the future of AI. They already know that AI has got where it is only by harvesting and copying and repurposing what actual, real people have already done. Musicians, authors, creative and inventive people of every sort. Kids already know that AI has gone as far as it's going to go, that it's already cannibalizing output from, well, from other AI. The fake and the error-ridden and the just plain crap is being cheerfully, mindlessly recycled and repurposed by more AI. Error begetting error. Weakness begetting weakness. You'd have to be blind or willfully blind not to see how this ends, how the snake inevitably, and like it does in the oldest stories, ends up eating itself from the tail to the head. And I say again, this observation is coming from the very youngsters a fraudster like Starmer claims he wants to protect by banning them from the social media from which they learned all of this truth in the first place. Talk about hoist by your own petard. The state, the dying state, a diseased and infected entity, if ever there was one, and only the most obvious, visible part of the greater disease of totalitarianism or centralization, of dictatorship, is manned by the most frightened people the world has yet seen. The would-be totalitarians are frightened enough of their own shadows, but they're certainly terrified of us. I've said before that the most telling trait of psychopaths is their utter lack of empathy, which means that while they're obsessed with human beings and appalled and therefore terrified of human beings, they simply cannot do human themselves. They signally fail to pass themselves off as fully human. It's the one thing they can't do and the only thing they can't buy or even steal. Watching the terrified totalitarians watching us being human, is like watching a frightened cat being carried through an airport terminal in one of those little plastic crates, wide-eyed and hissing at everything it sees and cannot comprehend. This is why they need control. This is why they would replace the wonder of humankind and human nature and all of that unpredictable and limitless potential of real people with a digital alternative, with what we are battered into calling AI. Artificial intelligence. The problem the totalitarians have, the Achilles heel that is already their undoing, is that the pesky people have long since worked it all out, seen what's going on, and in so doing, identified the psychos. All they have left is to shut us down, or rather, shut us up. They see us talking on social media, the same platforms they themselves launched to harvest all of our private data in the first place. They see us talking on there, talking about the psychos, about the control freaks, the perverts, and what they're doing. And it utterly terrifies them. That's what this latest move, fronted by factotums and stooges like Starmer, is all about. It's about seizing control of the means by which we talk to each other about them and about what they're doing. And what, most importantly, they're trying to do. And so we get what we've got. The latest transparent bid to use the false flag of endangered children as cover for a last-ditch bid on behalf of corrupt entities once and for all to silence dissent and control the people instead. Again, I say, just, finally, and forever, if you would, you pathetic bunch of artificial idiots, just go away. Thanks for watching. If you've enjoyed this content by me, Neil Oliver, don't forget to click and subscribe. And if you haven't already done so, go to the App Store and download the GB News app. Hello, everyone. How lovely to be with you again. Today, I'm talking to you from one of the most beautiful places in Scotland. Or I will be in a moment. I'm going to talk about the breakdown of trust. Simple as that. And the devastating impact that the loss of trust has on society. But before I set off, and this is really important and heartfelt, honestly, I want to say a big thank you to everyone who helps
support the channel and makes it possible, keeps it going financially. All the Patreon people who pay by the month, you know, who pay as you go, and thereby you are the lifeblood on a, you know, a minute by minute basis of what makes all of this possible. And also, and some of these are the same people, also people who send in donations, which also becomes part of the reservoir that we are able to draw upon to make the podcast. I see every single one. I know about every single one, every farthing, penny, sixpence, and other sums besides. Your support makes it possible for me to be here. It's that simple, and my gratitude is 24 carat. If you want to help and make sure the channel continues, please go to patreon.com at the first instance. It'll cost you the equivalent of a cup of coffee every month. You can also pay for a year in advance if you want, and that brings the costs down for you. Have a look. See if it makes sense. The details are in the notes below the video. You can also find all of that on my website, which is neiloliver.com. I will hope to see you there, come hell or high water. Okay, it's now time to set off into the unmistakable and unbeatable Scottish Highlands for today's monologue.
Trust. It all comes down to trust in society, really. So many aspects of a currency. People really ultimately have to trust a currency for it to work, you know, be it pounds or dollars or euros or yuans. How you structure your society, it could be a monarchy, a constitutional monarchy like we have or supposed to have in the UK. It could be a republic, as in the United States. Any one of many forms of democracy. It comes down to people trusting it. You can try a police state if you want. The Soviet Union became a police state, but it's enervating. It takes so much effort to make it happen, because ultimately you need one policeman for every other person. You can talk about police and you can talk about governance, and I suppose implicit within that is the idea of, you know, the necessity for force or obedience of some sort. But realistically, people within a society based on trust govern themselves. The police can't do it. It's not realistic if everyone's disobedient. You can't arrest everyone. There's never enough jails. But that doesn't happen because people govern themselves, but only if there's trust. And all around us at the moment, we're just seeing trust eroded and trust debased, like a currency. A currency becomes increasingly untrustworthy for the people who are expected to use it, where it's debased and corrupted. And when I get into the story of the massacre of Glencoe, the atrocity that happened here in the 17th century, fundamentally what has persisted in people's memories, the residue of sadness, has its deepest well in a terrible breach of trust. But we're seeing so much around us now of breach of trust. So many people right this moment are worried about, and rightly so, the imposition of digital ID in Britain under the so-called Labour government. Yet again, there's an attempt being made to make digital ID all but mandatory, because everyone's going to need, you would think, or we're being told, a digital ID to access the internet, to shop online, to check your emails, you know, to watch YouTube. And it's a breach of trust. People are worried about artificial intelligence, AI, because they see that what had initially been offered to them as convenient and a boon to all mankind apparently threatens their employment. You know, people are being told, or they're understanding for themselves, that their jobs, the way they earn a living, is going to be swallowed by artificial intelligence. People have let so much technology and so much of the modern world into their lives on trust. And it will work. It would have worked as long as there was trust. But the trust is going now. And you'll get the consequences. I would say that despite what people are being led to fear, what people are being led to believe, the technocracy, the digital ID, the digital cage, all of the infrastructure, the central bank digital currencies, the mood music is that all of that is inescapable, and that once the door closes shut on the digital cage, that we're all trapped inside it forever. But I think that's just propaganda. That is the heart of the propaganda, because without the cooperation of the people, and that cooperation based ultimately on trust, ultimately, I suppose, because there's something in it for the people, it won't work. It won't work. Talk about a lot of us were taught to believe in a social contract whereby people accept certain limitations, they obey the law, they cooperate with law and legislation because there's something in it for them. And the something that's in it for them, well, it's all the benefits of society. It's peace. It's being able to walk down the street at night. It's knowing that there'll be food in the shops. It's knowing that the lights will come on and the bins will be emptied. It's knowing that your children will be safe, that you can let them out of the house and go about their lives safely. And that's the social contract. But the social contract has been corrupted. It's been soiled and traduced. And I would say that counter to the mood music, and despite what the technocrats would like us to think, and perhaps think that we think, all of it will fail. All of it will fail. Because the trust is gone. And you cannot force governance on millions or billions of people. It just won't work. The trust for me went during COVID. You know, as I've said many times, maybe up until that point, I was just a trusting fool. I'm prepared to accept that. I trusted that I lived in a democracy because I was told from school onwards that I lived in a democracy, and I was told by people that I trusted. And I was told that I was a very lucky person to live in the society in which I lived. And I believed it because I trusted the people that were telling me. And fundamentally, regardless of whether it was a Conservative government or a Labour government, I trusted that at base they had my fundamental interests at heart, mine and my family's. I might not agree with their ideology, but I thought, well, they're going to make sure that things are basically all right and I can get on with my life. And I thought that because I trusted the people that told me. Now, trust is a very fragile entity. You know, if you have a vase and you're accustomed to filling it with water so you can put flowers in it, you trust the integrity of the vase. If that vase gets broken, dropped accidentally and shattered into many pieces, even if you glue it back together again, even if it's done expertly so that you can't see the joins, you would never trust it the way you had before. You might never put water in it again. You might just keep it as an attractive object. And for me, the trust went during COVID because for all the aforementioned reasons,
I trusted what I was being told at the beginning. I watched the films coming out of China of people face planting. Apparently because they were so ill, so fast, that while they were out waiting for a bus, they just dropped dead. And I saw the footage coming out of Italy of the convoys of trucks bearing away the dead. Sort of Black Death style. I trusted what I was seeing. And then I learned that the face-planting Chinese people were actors. And sure enough, when you watched it again in that knowledge, you could see that they were putting their hands out to take the fall. And then I learned that the convoys of trucks in Italy, that each one of the trucks had in it a single coffin, if that. And so it went on. I believed that there was a necessity to lock down at first. I believed it when I was told that we might have to avoid one another. I believed that because I trusted the source of the information. And when it got to my trust was so eroded that by the time it came to the jabs, I was unsure. I thought, how does this fit in? And because the trust was gone, well, I didn't take the jab. Neither did my wife, neither did my kids. And once you become aware of the fact that you don't trust anymore, it changes everything. It changed everything for me. And so you look out at the way in which, you know, one politician, one president of the United States after another, campaigns promising peace, promising to stop war, to get out of war, to seek peace. And they invariably get elected because that's what people want. They don't want war, they want peace. And every single time that individual that had campaigned promising peace foments war once in office, so that the trust has been misplaced. Donald Trump's done it. Notoriously, Donald Trump promised to get America out of the forever wars, to secure peace in Ukraine, to never again get involved in a hopeless forever war in the Middle East. And then he was no sooner in office than he was doing the opposite. Not just maintaining the war in Ukraine, but launching a new war in the Middle East. So you've got tens, I don't know, hundreds of millions of Americans, tax-paying, tax-mugged citizens, who voted for a president promising peace, and now they find themselves involved in a dreadful war against Iran. And they see their administration, their regime, paying for genocide in Gaza and in the Lebanon. And the people can't get rid. All over Europe, you see the rise of alternative political movements. I've said before and I'll say again, I'm sceptical about any possibility of anybody voting themselves out of this trouble, but the instinct is there. People want political alternative. So you see it all over, you know, the alternative for Germany, for example, the AfD, where the response of the regime is to try and make the AfD illegal, you know, surveilling its would-be candidates and arresting people just for posing, being a threat to the incumbents. So the trust in the political system, not just for me, but for millions, billions of people, is gone. What do people do then if the mechanisms that they've been told to trust are demonstrably useless? What do you get? Well, apart from anything else, you get loss of trust. In Britain, where I am, we've got a Labour government which is making moves to ensure that whoever replaces Starmer. The state is manoeuvring to ensure that whoever it is that comes in will have no option but to perpetuate war, to seek war with Russia, to be committed to what is now ingrained as Project Ukraine. And even if that war with Ukraine had somehow come to some sort of conclusion, if it was no longer about Ukraine, the mechanisms are being put in place to ensure that, come what may, Europe, and Britain is a part of it, seeks war with Russia. And the people don't want it. The people don't want that. The people want peace. Most people don't really understand, if they even bother to think, they don't know why Russia's supposed to be the enemy. But apart from that, people want peace. And the likelihood that any of them will trust again, in the short to medium, even to the long-term future, that any soapboxing, preaching politician who offers peace, they will not be believed. No one's going to trust America in a peace deal. The much-vaunted peace deal with Iran, that's not worth the paper it's printed on. People have drawn the conclusion that even if a peace deal is signed between the United States of America and Russia and Israel, that as soon as the ink's dry, it'll be cast aside and the aggressors will go to war again. That's no way to run a world. This is a part of the Valley of Glencoe that they call the Three Sisters, because of these three great eminences. I have to tell you, even in June, seeing the sun on them, it's pretty special, because it can be pretty moody here. Look at that sky. Look at that lowering, glowering sky. So Glencoe, somewhere up here, was the home of a sept, which is to say a little bit, a portion of the bigger MacDonald clan, one of the most famous clan names in Scotland. The MacDonalds, their ancestor was Somerled, Somerled is the way it's normally rendered, but it does mean what it sounds like, which is to say led by the summer, and it refers to an ancestor who was a Viking, who had come out of Scandinavia at some point in the distant past. Like all Scots, like all the Scottish clans, the Picts and the rest of it, they ultimately claimed their line of descent, and they still do, from, well, all the way back to Noah, really. The original father of all is Noah for most Scottish clans, but in the more recent past, you would say, it's Somerled for the MacDonalds. And it's a big collective, but the little sept of the MacDonalds who lived in a valley hereabouts, it was quite a small group, just a few hundred, and economically speaking, they were down on their uppers, as we say. They were quite poor, and they relied, as many did, on cattle rustling, actually, taking their neighbours' cattle and hiding them. They had a hidden valley up here, somewhere out of sight, where they could keep the beasts that they had taken. Their leader, their chief, was called the MacIan. The MacIan. He was a big, fine-looking man, so I think long-haired Sean Connery. Big, tall man, 6 foot tall, long grey hair, long grey beard. The MacIan. And he might not have had much in the way of liquid cash, but he was a proud figure. The massacre of Glencoe happened, unfolded, the violence anyway, on the 13th February, 1692. So in the heart of winter. The MacDonalds had been asked, they'd really been given little option, but they had been asked to provide bed and board for a company of soldiers
government soldiers, government redcoats, who were ostensibly, as they presented it to the McDonald's, they were passing through collecting taxes, unpaid taxes, and they wanted to stay for a few days, a few weeks. And so the McDonald's agreed to put them up, and they thereby invoked a great tradition of the Highlands, which was hospitality. It was an obligation felt by the McDonald's anyway to provide that shelter. They didn't have much, but in terms of the custom, they were obliged, on their honour, to share what they had. The shelter, the fire, the food and drink. So they offered these soldiers bed and board. And they were here for weeks, at a time when, you know, stored supplies were, you know, under pressure, because it was in the at the height of winter. And the McKeon had some time previously failed, largely because he was overtaken by the weather, to meet a deadline. He had been asked to come in, as all the clan chiefs had been, to swear an oath of allegiance to the new king, which was William, the new king who'd come in on the back of the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688. They'd been told to swear an oath of allegiance, but because of the time of year, the McKeon had failed to get to the appointed place within the appointed time. So he had transgressed. Unbeknownst to him, he and his had been singled out. That was the excuse for what then unfolded. And the soldiers had come and they had stayed. They had taken advantage of the hospitality of the McDonald's of Glencoe. And then on the night of the 12th of February 1692, the word came through. The message was delivered to the commander that they were to enact a slaughter. An example was to be made of the McDonald's of Glencoe, and they were all to be killed. And so, in the small hours of the 13th of February 1692, the soldiers set about that. And they were dotted all about in houses, accommodation, all about the valley. And men were pulled from their beds and murdered, and women and children, the elderly, they were driven off where they died in the, you know, they died in the snow. The official figures, I think the official figure is in the high 30s, but it's not really known. And the pride of the McDonald's probably meant that they didn't ever divulge how many people had died, how many of their own they had lost. But many, many more than 38 were murdered by the government in the most egregious, unforgivable and unforgettable breach of trust. And it's never been forgotten. The dirty work, the murder was committed against the McDonald's by men who were in the main Campbells. And there was a long traditional feuding enmity between the Campbells and the McDonald's. But for what was done here in on the 13th of February 1692, that is the great wrong and the cause of the great sadness. There's still a pub nearby where there's a sign on the door that to this day, I believe, says no Campbells. It's funny and it's not funny. And it's a memory. But trust. That breach of trust then, that unforgivable, unforgettable breach of trust, is what defines Glencoe. That's what people think of. And although it was only meted out to a few score, maybe 100 people, it's never been forgotten. Because when you breach trust, when you break trust, when you take advantage of the trust that people have placed in you, they don't forget. I think it was Walter Scott said, "Breathes there a man with soul so dead, who never to himself has said, this is my own, my native land." This is, well, behind me,
The landmark is the Ballachulish Bridge. I remember when I was a wee boy travelling up here with my dad, I remember crossing these narrows, not by bridge, but by a little ferry. Tiny little ferry. I think it only took maybe four or half a dozen vehicles at a time. And in high summer, it could mean queues back down the road for quite a while and a bit of a wait, but they were more leisurely times, I suppose. Whether the bridge was actually under construction or there, but not in use at the time that I was crossing on the ferry, I don't know. But my memories here go back quite a long way. I was speaking about trust and the loss of trust, which is there for me. And I know from talking to people that it's a reality now for a lot of people. Loss of trust in all of the entities that so many of us were raised to trust. A conclusion that I've come to in the last few years was quite, I don't know, almost shattering for me. I was certainly taught at university in my archaeology classes in relation to being encouraged to contemplate the deep past. You know, the Homo sapiens has been around for several hundred thousand years at least. And the message from my teachers was always that Homo sapiens are all the same and have always been the same. And that obviously there have evolved cultural differences, historical differences, different trajectories, but that people are all the same and that fundamentally they're only made to appear different by their circumstances. You know, the implication was that you could take a Homo sapiens from 100,000 years ago and give him a shave and a suit and pretty soon he'd be working as a dentist or a plumber and you wouldn't notice him. And I accepted that for the longest time. I thought, yeah, there's Homo sapiens consciousness and we're all the same if you get down deep enough. That shattering revelation of recent years for me is that I don't think that anymore. I don't think there's just one type of Homo sapiens. And I don't think we're all the same. I don't know. I don't think it's very easy to spot the difference, where the difference is. And it could be, we could be split into multiple variations. But I think there's at least two. I think there's one side and another side. At a fundamental level, there's two groups of humans that look the same but aren't. And I think, you know, maybe by their fruits shall ye know them. Maybe by their fruits shall ye tell the difference. I don't know. Maybe. I think for me, there's a difference. One of the differences, one of the fundamental differences, is that there are those who cannot, not just will not, but cannot live and let live. They cannot. It's in the genes, if you like. It's in the blueprint, hardwired, that they cannot live and let live. And I think it's one of the wonders and mysteries of the mind that what's not there, what's absent in an individual, there is no way for that individual, with the best will in the world, to detect and identify the absence. Because it's in the nature of the mind that any absence, any gap, is stitched over completely and invisibly. It's the ne plus ultra of absent. It's less than gone. It's more than gone. It's less than nothing. You cannot know that you're without a trait, because your mind sees to it that you don't see it. But anyway, when it comes to my feelings about trust, I have simply learned that it's on me. It was unnecessary. It was irresponsible of me to have trusted people I don't know. You can make the choice to choose people that you feel you know, whoever they are. But I trusted people I didn't know, people I'd never met and who'd never met me. I trusted them. And I see that that wasn't their mistake, that's mine. I shouldn't have done that. I should not have placed that onerous responsibility of my well-being on people I don't know and who don't know me, don't even know I exist. That's the lesson for me about trust. So I won't ever again trust people I don't know. And I'll certainly never again trust the state. And I think over and over again about how much truth is there in "By their fruits shall you know them." That big dark triangle is Buccellete of Moher, which is Gaelic, means the big shepherd. The very noticeable building is the King's House. The King's House is a legendary way station in this part of the world. Buccellete of Moher is like a sentinel standing guard over the entrance to Glencoe. You'd have to give it its due. This is a world-class landscape. You might find other places that are as impressive, but you won't find anywhere more impressive. And you can also tell the way the weather is coming in. I'm filming this in June. It doesn't matter what time of year you come here, you have to be ready for all kinds of weather. It could snow in July. Glencoe is, well, it's a name that doesn't translate terribly clearly. There's no consensus. Glen, obviously, is valley, but Coe, if it's Gaelic, it doesn't have an obvious translation. Most people, because of what happened here at the tail end of the 17th century, translate it as the Valley of Sadness or the Valley of Tears, which is ironic for such a beautiful, beautiful place.
Thanks for watching. If you've enjoyed this content by me, Neil Oliver, don't forget to click and subscribe. And if you haven't already done so, go to the App Store and download the GB News app.